Today, to infinity and beyond, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 16th of November, 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In our weekly digest, we look at the new market highs in the US and mixed signals about the US economy, whilst in Australia, despite the continuing weak economic data, the RBA says it doesn't worry about rising levels of mortgage default, and some commentators are now talking about home prices rising hard next year. As always, we start with international scene, but if you want to jump directly to the Australian section, the time is shown below, and there is a list of the main items in today's post in the comments below. And before we start, a reminder that we'll be running our next live stream on Tuesday, the 19th of November at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You're welcome to join the live chat and ask me a question in real time or beforehand via the DFA blog, and we'll be updating our scenarios and looking at the latest from the RBA, and we'll also be discussing the trajectory of home prices. In New York, Wall Street's main stock indices closed at record levels on Friday. The S&P 500 hit its sixth straight week of gains, its longest such weekly streak in about 2 years, while the Dow topped 28,000 for the first time. A month ago, the fear was recession, recession, recession. Those recession headlines haven't shown up now in 9 or 10 trading sessions. And you can thank the Federal Reserve's interest rate cuts, plus third quarter earnings bettering low expectations, and news on the trade talks, which swung positive as that roller coaster continues. With White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow saying on Thursday that the United States and China are getting close to a trade agreement, citing what he called very constructive talks with Beijing. Earlier in the week, there were more doubts centred on the agricultural sector, with China balking about agreeing to a dollar amount of purchase of US farm products, and it also wants tariffs set for the December period to be rescinded. The gains came as President Donald Trump made an announcement on healthcare price transparency, where regulatory and election risks have contributed to the healthcare sector's underperformance in 2019. Data on Friday showed that US retail sales rebounded in October with a 0.3% rise, but consumers cut back on purchases of big-ticket household items and clothing, which could temper expectations for a strong holiday shopping season. But under the hood, there are still some worrisome signs. For example, the CASS Freight Index showed freight shipment volumes fell not only below the October 2018 level, but also below the October 2017 and October 2014 levels. And this is significant because that predates the tariff era and attempts by some to ship forward to avoid future taxes. This is an important measure of the goods-based economy. It tracks shipment volumes of consumer goods and industrial goods such as construction materials, products, equipment, and components being shipped to or by manufacturers, and supplies and equipment for oil and gas drilling. But it does not track bulk commodities such as grains. And overall freight shipping volumes in the US by truck, rail, air and barge fell 5.8% in October 2019 compared to October last year. It was the 11th month in a row of year-over-year declines, and the third month out of those 11 when year-over-year declines were around 6%. The transportation sector is linked tightly to the goods-based economy, while services such as finance, insurance and healthcare dominate the US economy, and the goods-based sector is smaller by comparison. Transportation is also a service, and like some other services, it depends on the goods-based sector and reflects its weakness. So these weak numbers could flow on. Yet Jerome Powell's testimony was all about the economy being in good shape. He said the economy is recovering, but the slow pace means that monetary policy needs to remain accommodative. According to Powell, there's a lot to like about the labour market, but it's a puzzle as to why we're not seeing more upticks in wages. This may have something to do with low inflation and the fact that low inflation and lower growth is the, quote, new normal. This isn't likely to change in the near term, which is why interest rate hikes are not on the horizon. And he also admits that there are downside risks and there's nothing booming in the economy that could go bust. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.8% to 28,004, and that was up 1.7% over the week, finishing with its fourth weekly gain in a row. The S&P 500 gained 0.77% to 3,120, finishing higher for a sixth straight week, and the Nasdaq Composite added 0.73% to 8,541 and finished higher for the seventh straight week. The Volatility Index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 7.66% to 12.05, and that is a new six-month low. For the year, the S&P 500 is up 24.5%, with the Dow up 20%, and the Nasdaq up 28.7%. And the market has spent much of 2019 recovering from the slump that hit stocks in the fourth quarter of 2018, when the Fed was lifting rates. The major averages are well on their track for their biggest one-year gains since 2013, and as a result, some are suggesting that this could mean the market is overbought and vulnerable to a pullback. The 10-year Treasury yield rose to 1.834% from Thursday's 1.815%. The yield is 8.66% higher for the month, but off 5.7% for the week, in a significant switch. The 30-year also slid back to 2.308% at the close, while the three-month stood at 1.569. Whilst the previous yield curve inversion has gone for now, it's worth remembering that the same happened in previous cycles before the recession, which often follows on the back of short-term rates being higher than long-term rates. Oil prices moved higher, with the West Texas Intermediate crude moving up 1.96% to $57.99 a barrel, which is a six-week high. And gold fell 0.32% to $1,468 as investors looked to put money in stocks and related assets. While gold rose 0.4% on the week, it is down 3.1% so far in November. And the US dollar index futures was down 0.17% to 97.85, and the euro US dollar was up 0.29% to 1.1053, while Bitcoin fell again 1.75% to 8,519. Elsewhere, the final Hong Kong gross domestic product data for the 3 months ending September confirmed the economy contracted for the second consecutive quarter, meeting the technical definition of a recession. GDP fell 3.2% on the quarter, and that's the biggest drop since the start of 2009. While Hong Kong is relatively small, it plays an outsized role in the Asian economy, and the major civil unrest there continues. Sterling shrugged off back-to-back disappointments in economic data to end the week at eight-day highs of 1.2907. While Brexit is taking its toll on the UK economy, investors are relieved that the UK won't be spiralling out of the EU and that Nigel Farage reduced his Brexit Party challenge this past week. However, the UK economy is slowing. Over the past week, we've seen GDP growth fall short of expectations, the trade deficit widen, industrial production contract for the second month in a row, job losses are mounting, and wage growth is easing. And most importantly, the CPI and retail sales declined in October. And I guess if next week's manufacturing, service and construction sector PMI report shows a further slowdown in November, then the pound US dollar won't be able to hold on to its gains. And weak economic news popped up around midweek from China and Germany, which avoided the technical recession, and Japan, which is perhaps why bond yields moved lower. Typically, high bond prices might suggest dollar weakness, but the US still looks like the best house on the block. And closer to home, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand surprised the market when they left interest rates unchanged this week at 1%. According to Governor Orr, there is no urgency to act at this point because the lower New Zealand dollar is supporting the economy. The central bank feels that policy is already very stimulatory and rates will need to stay low for a long period of time. They think that the economy is near a turning point and there could be acceleration. But according to the Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Buscard, if pickup fails to materialise, we'll do more. The central bank is done for the year, but they haven't ruled out additional easing in 2020. In fact, Reserve Bank Assistant Governor Hawkesbury said February is a live meeting, but a rate cut would require a material change to the outlook. And Governor Orr seems to agree. He said, we're starting to see signs of pickup in activity, but the door is open for a rate cut if needed. Considering that the next policy meeting won't be for another 3 months, the Reserve Bank New Zealand's decision to leave rates unchanged should have residual impact on the currency. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so, to the local market, the Australian dollar took a nosedive to its weakest level in nearly a month on the back of disappointing labour data, as jobs growth unexpectedly declined in October, with more than 19,000 full-time and part-time jobs lost. This drove the unemployment rate up to 5.3% seasonally adjusted, and the participation rate down just a little to 66%. And you can see our post-employment look shaky in October for more. The monthly trend unemployment rate remains steady in Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia and the Australian Capital Territory, but the unemployment rate increased in the Northern Territory and New South Wales and decreased in Tasmania. Australian wage growth eased down last quarter with the annual growth at 2.2%, down from 2.3% last quarter when economists had expected it to hold steady. And growth was stronger in the public sector compared to the private sector. And the original data by state shows that Tasmania and Victoria were doing better than average, while Western Australia and the Northern Territory are below average. And in original terms, rises through the year to the September quarter 2019 at an industry level ranged from 1.9% for information, media and telecommunications up to 3.2% for healthcare and social assistance. Wage growth remains one of the key challenges for the Australian economy, said Callum Pickering, economist at global job site Indeed. It is the key for household spending, inflation and monetary policy. Still, Wednesday's figures will be of no surprise to the RBA, which only last week forecast a subdued 2.3% pace through to the end of 2021. Worth remembering that government forecasts were for wage growth of 2.75% for the financial year ending June 2020 and, wait for it, 3.25% the following year. Separately, a survey of Australian consumers showed sentiment remained below average, despite three interest rate cuts since June, with pessimists outnumbering optimists. Consumer sentiment, though dour, did pick up a bit in November from the previous month, and it was led largely by a reported wider recovery in home prices across the country. Sentiment among mortgagees increased 4.9%, while that of homeowners jumped 8%, and the index measuring time to buy a dwelling improved by 2.1%. This all points to more weakness in household consumption. The cash rate cuts and tax refunds are not making much of a difference. And the debate about how much home prices are rising or not rising rages on, with CoreLogic at the bullish end of the spectrum. Their index shows that over the past year, Melbourne has clawed back all of the losses, though is still more than 5% down from its previous peak, while in Sydney, the fall over the past year is now a net minus 0.6%, still though down 9.2% from the previous peak. And the data for Sydney shows that for the last quarter, prices have risen by 6.02%. Remember that figure, because REA, the firm behind realestate.com.au, has just come out with a video showing that in the last quarter, Sydney prices have risen by, wait for it, 0.8%. So you can pay your money and take your pick. Of course, all the spruikers will go with the core logic story, including the mainstream media and the government. But what if REA is right? A small rise, averaged across the board, with some postcodes doing better than others, is also what I'm seeing in my data. And there has been mega silliness on Twitter about all this. That said, CoreLogic's head of research, Tim Lawless, said, if this trend continues, we could see property prices reach new heights early next year. But he then went on to say that housing affordability is a major issue, with average dwelling-to-income ratios in Sydney at 8.2 times and in Melbourne 7.2 times. It takes on average 11 years in Sydney to save for a 15% deposit and 9.6 years in Melbourne. If prices are indeed rising rapidly in Sydney and Melbourne, this shouts systemic risk and high household debt. If the truth is in REA's favour, then the price propaganda is astonishing and negative equity a bigger issue. Either way, many will be misled. Louis Christopher from SQM Research expects growth in housing prices in Australia's capital cities to average 11% in 2020 in the latest edition of their Housing Boom and Bust report. They forecast that dwelling prices in Melbourne will rise by up to 15%, while Sydney's housing market will record record growth of 10 to 14%. However, Christopher says that the housing market rebound is unlikely to be sustained over the longer term, stating in the AFR, I think this is going to be a relatively short recovery. The previous boom, which started in 2013 through to mid-2017, had lasted for more than 4 years. And in Mr. Christopher's view, the current upswing could fizzle out as early as 2021. I do have some concerns, he said, about the recent rapid growth. And CBA, based on the CoreLogic series, is forecasting that property prices in Sydney and Melbourne will rise by 7% and 8% respectively over 2020. For Brisbane and Perth, they see prices rising more modestly. And nationally, they think prices will rise by 6%. They believe they can forecast dwelling prices over the near term with a, quote, reasonable degree of confidence. We'll see. Auctions were clearing at around 70.6%, according to CoreLogic, with numbers listed now close to last year's count when, of course, the market had already slowed. Sydney reported 76.8% clearance, compared with 42.1% last year, and Melbourne 70.8% compared with 46.2% last year. And this gives 1,495 cleared auctions compared with 1,250 a year ago, still lowish volumes. And a report was published this week by around 20 debt counselling and advocacy groups based on our analysis of consumer debt. Payday loans targeting the financially vulnerable are being taken out at the rate of more than $30,000 a week, with the amount borrowed in Australia on track to be worth $1.7 billion by year's end. The new data on the industry shows that 4.7 million individual loans worth an estimated $3 billion have been paid out in the past 3 years, with more than 310,000 extra households taking on the high-interest debt products since mid-2016. The number of loans being written per month has skyrocketed from 100,000 a month in 2016 to more than 135,000 a month this year, generating lenders an estimated $550 million profit over the past 3 years. And we show that the number of financially stressed households with payday loans has jumped from just 21,000 in 2010 to 554,000 now. And there is a group in the community that are increasingly doing it tough. For those lower income working folk, their lives are becoming increasingly insecure, and that is why they are turning to this industry. And construction insolvencies are booming, according to ASIC, who said that insolvencies in the $150 billion residential and non-residential construction industry remains at a high level. Insolvencies in the 3 months to September jumped 78% in Victoria, 41% in Queensland, and 7% in New South Wales. This was a significant contributor to the 5% increase in year-on-year national defaults to 2,309 across all industries, with 22% coming from construction. Comparable figures for the past 12 months were 8,232 insolvencies, of which 20% was in construction. And property developers, both domestic and foreign, are being forced to sell as the market slows, so expect more pain ahead. Finally, the RBA came out with an analysis of mortgage arrears when Deputy Governor Guy DeBell spoke at FINSIA. He said that arrears are an important indicator of the financial health of households and so have implications for the assessment of the broader economic conditions and the economy overall. The mortgage arrears rate at 1%, he says, is low by both historical and international standards, but is, I would say, based on a skewed securitisation data set, which the RBA insists on using. Arrears in the US peaked at around 10% during the financial crisis. And the largest increase in loan arrears has occurred in Western Australia and the Northern Territory, where economic conditions have been weak and the unemployment rate has risen. In all states, increases in the share of housing loans that are 90-day plus in arrears has been mainly driven by loans remaining in arrears for longer, he said, rather than more loans entering arrears. This suggests households are finding it harder to resolve the situation than previously and is consistent with the softer housing market conditions. And this is especially so, he said, in Western Australia. In fact, banks, we think, have been tightening the screws to try to solve delinquency quicker, and there are now more for sales. The increase in arrears for interest-only and principal interest loans have been roughly similar. In Western Australia, around half of loans that were originated on interest-only terms and that are in arrears are also in negative equity, and this compares to around 40% of principal interest loans in arrears. Moreover, interest-only borrowers are less likely to have buffers in the form of prepayments or balances to offset accounts. A bit more than 40% of interest-only borrowers have no buffers of this sort at all, compared to around 20% of principal and interest borrowers. And finally, nationally, around 15% of loans that are in arrears are also in negative equity, though the basis on which the property is marked to market is, in my view, very high level, and our own DFA modelling suggests that negative equity is a more significant issue. The RBA continues to peddle the nothing-to-see-here story, despite the high levels of mortgage stress and the deeper price falls in the system, especially in areas of higher delinquency. And do remember that it can take many years for loans to finally go bad because people will try to maintain payments for months and years whilst drifting further into debt and difficulty. Finally, the ASX 100 ended on Friday up 0.86% to 5,627, which is still below its record peak of 5,660 back in July. The financials index was down to 6,219 thanks to several banks going ex-dividend, and the volatility index was lower again, down to 10.79 and down 1.64% on Friday. The Aussie was at 68.20. The Euro Aussie was at 1.6212, while the gold Aussie cross was at 2,151, down 0.75%, and the Aussie Bitcoin cross was down 2.39% to 12,493. So stepping back, the economic data remains fragile. The true state of play on housing prices remains unclear. Watch for an upcoming post with John Adams and I shortly. While internationally, equities are still overbought in a still uncertain market, but expect prices of equities to run higher for now. The question is, for how long and how high will they go? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.